A recent review of U.S. special education data revealed a threefold increase in autism and a fourfold increase in delayed development among public school children. That leads us to ask, can bad food make good genes go bad?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,405th edition of the Food Chain Radio podcast. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Montevideo who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Folks, consider Michael Olson's third law of the food chain: cheap food isn't. Given the hyperinflation of the past few years, in which a $10 restaurant hamburger became a $20 hamburger, many parents are looking for ways to stretch the family's food dollar. Many parents are also working two jobs and have very little free time, and so are also looking for ways to save time. Not enough money, not enough time. Industry to the rescue with cheap, ultra-processed, ready-to-eat foods. But wait, what is causing that threefold increase in autism and that fourfold increase in delayed development among students enrolled in U.S. public schools? Could the ultra-processed foods parents feed children be the cause of this childhood catastrophe? Well, let's ask Dr. Renee DeFault, who is the executive director and principal investigator at the Food Ingredient and Health Research Institute. Dr. Renee, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thank you, Michael. It's a pleasure to be here again. It's been a while since
we've been. Yeah, it's been a while. A lot of water has passed underneath the bridge, but things are still the same when it gets right down to the nitty-gritty. Dr. Renee, you're a research scientist, an author, a college professor, a special education teacher, and a whistleblower. Are you willing to blow the whistle on ultra-processed food as being a cause of autism and delayed development in children?
Absolutely, and I'm not the only one. I've been blowing the whistle now for about 20 years, ever since I found the mercury in the high fructose corn syrup while I was working at FDA. But the nice thing about this day and age is that researchers all over the world are now also blowing the whistle on ultra-processed foods. And really big studies coming out showing that a mother's risk of having a child with autism and ADHD is increased significantly with her consumption of ultra-processed foods. So the real...
Dr. Renee, do you think it is a potential cause or is it a probable cause?
It's a probable. Yeah, I have no doubt on that. I've been researching this and publishing and whatnot for years, doing clinical trial work. There's no doubt in my mind that it's that is the culprit.
Well, good. Let's step back to your work with the Food and Drug Administration as a researcher. As I understand it, the federal government is not responsible for determining the efficacy of foods that have been manufactured or drugs. That is all up to industry to determine whether it's good food or bad food. Is that not true?
Absolutely. It's been that way since the beginning, really. Congress gives FDA power to do certain things. And for example, FDA can collect fees from pharmaceutical companies to pay for FDA employees to review their applications for new drugs. And so they have a pay-to-play system in place. And that's an example of you know, how Congress determines what FDA can and can't do. And whether or not something is safe to eat, the food manufacturers, it's upon them to determine whether something is safe or not when it comes to chemicals.
Okay. So they quite naturally are probably looking for ways to prove, hey, this is good stuff to eat.
Right.
Okay. And what were you doing then at the Food and Drug Administration?
Well, I was working for the commissioner's office, and my main job was to do cleanup work of contaminated FDA laboratory properties. And so my background was in toxicology and industrial hygiene, which is basically the study and auditing of different processes to determine what's the risk of contamination in the environment. And so I stumbled upon mercury in plumbing systems of laboratories and started asking where did that come from. And it turned out it came from chemicals that were made with mercury, the mercury grade chloralkali chemicals. And then I asked, well, who else is using these chemicals? And it turned out the corn refiners, they were the biggest user at the time. And I asked, well, could there be mercury in the high fructose corn syrup? And at the time, Americans were consuming 60 pounds per year per person. So I thought, wow, that we need to look into this. And sure enough, we found mercury in about half the samples we collected. I had sent some FDA law enforcement officers right out to the corn refiner plants, and they collected the samples. And so anyway, bottom line is, when I wanted to publish those findings, and I had figured out what it would do to the body, especially in developing children, and I had worked with collaborators and whatnot, and done the entire literature review to find out what we did know about mercury and its impact on developing children. FDA didn't want that published, so I had to retire early and take a cut in my pension in order to continue the line of research, which is now known as nutritional epigenetics, how what we eat determines how our genes behave to create conditions for disease or disorders. And in my line, I'm looking primarily at neurodevelopmental disorders.
So the federal government said, don't publish.
Right. They said you can't publish using these.
And why did they say that? Why did the federal government prohibit you from telling what you know?
Because, well, I had gone down to the Center for Food Safety. I had collaborators outside the government who had also analyzed the samples from University of California, for example. And we gave a spiel and, said what we found. And I was taken aside and told by the person in charge at that time that in no uncertain terms that I would stop this line of research, that, that they have interests with the food corporations. And
Sure. They're good old revolving
right
door.
back in those days we called it a corporocracy, because everybody knew the influence of the corporations. Yeah,
Good.
so
And corn, high fructose corn syrup was a significant building block of the modern food chain, the ultra
oh
processed food chain.
absolutely still is. I mean, my goodness. Yeah, it's in baby corn syrup solids are in baby formulas. There are a number of sweeteners that fall into that corn product food line of production. So it's not just high fructose corn syrup and corn syrup. There's other sweeteners that fall in the same line. And there's three different ways that mercury can get into that manufacturing line. And yeah, so it is what it is. It's just a problem with the food industry. It's not just high fructose corn syrup. There are heavy metals found in many different food ingredients because of the manufacturing processes.
What, 95% of the baby food?
Yeah, that's a good example. Congress found, heavy metals in baby food. So it's a problem. And FDA didn't want to acknowledge it at the time. Now they do. 20 years later, they have a little web page up now that says that, they're going to try to do something about it. But really, the fact of the matter is that they can only do what Congress allows them to do, and Congress is not going to be allowing them to. If Congress wanted rules to make our food supply safer, we'd have them. Like European Union, they have rules in place banning certain food ingredients or requiring warning labels on certain food ingredients, like with food colors and whatnot. What we have because we don't have a willing Congress to
All
make
right.
change.
How would you define ultra processed foods?
Those are foods that, when you look on the label, the food ingredient label, There's a lot of things you can't even pronounce. And in some cases, ultra-processed foods now with the natural foods, you might be able to know what 7 out of 9 ingredients are. But the fact that there are so many ingredients to make that cracker or that, cookie or that salad dressing or whatever, that's ultra-processed. When you only have one ingredient, a whole food like, chicken or an orange or, bell pepper, that is not ultra processed. There is processing that goes into, preparing these agricultural crops to go to the market, but it's not like there's several steps in making these in terms of modern manufacturing. That every step you put, every ingredient that goes into that ultra processed foods, there's steps involved in making it, and then that increases the risk of contamination. So the more steps involved in creating a food product, because there's so many ingredients, then you're going to have multiple pathways for heavy metals or, in some cases, pesticide residues or other things.
Which,
So go ahead.
and those heavy metals appear to be getting into the food, and those heavy metals in the food appear to be getting into the brains of our children.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's no doubt about it. We have most of the really good studies are done outside the US at this point because the funding for foundational science is really not happening anymore because everything in the US is pushing towards products and new patents and things like that. But the foundational research, like, hey, I wonder, if we feed these rats mixed metals, mercury, cadmium, and lead, where is that metal going to go to in their tissue? So this rat study shows, well, it goes all over their body, throughout their body. The inorganic mercury, lead, and cadmium can be found in all these different places in their body, these organs and whatnot. So that's foundational research. There's no profit in that because you're not, you don't have the information isn't going to generate income.
So you were left on your own. So you quit the FDA and you went out and started researching on your own and you fund the research yourself. Why is that?
Well, we've had a couple small grants. The only federal funder we ever had was the Environmental Protection Agency because I had worked there in my career and I had a lot of respect. People there respected my work in Indian country and whatnot. And so they funded a couple clinical trials for us. And we found the direct association between inorganic mercury and processed foods in glucose levels in the human population. And we found that same association in the huge thousands and thousands of data points at the CDC's NHANES data set. So that's a real finding. And there was efforts to suppress those findings by ADM. And I have a whole story about that. But bottom line is we finally got it published and it's indexed by PubMed. And we now that know that there is a direct positive relationship between the mercury, the inorganic mercury in your blood, and the risk of diabetes.
And with that, we're going to take a quick break. But when we come back, we're going to have Dr. Renee tell us all about nutritional epigenetics and how, I guess you could say, it threatens the future of our people. Do stay tuned. This is the Food Chain. Michael Olson. We will be right back.
let's go back for more of What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Today, we're talking about nutritional epigenetics with Dr. Renee DeVault. Epigenetics, two big words, nutrition, ever relating to food, but genetics, epigenetics. What does epi mean?
That means above the gene. So like, you know, your skin, epidermis, that's above the tissues, right? Epidermis, and then epigenetics is above the gene. And that's simply mechanisms that influence the way the gene behaves. So like there's switches that can turn genes on and off. And these switches are impacted by what we eat. So nutritional epigenetics is how what we eat determines if our genes are going to be turned on or off.
So in effect, that they're actually controlling the how the DNA turns on and off then, correct?
Yeah, basically, if the DNA gets turned on because of a switch, then you get a protein that you may need or may not need because you have oncogenes, which are cancer-causing genes, and then you have other genes that, like, for example, when they turn on, you have a protein that is made or you know, instructions for a protein to be made that it's a metal carrier protein, and its primary job is to collect all the heavy metals in your body and then excrete them. So you can have good genes and bad genes.
And there it is. And what we eat can control these. Now, how long have we been aware of epigenetics? Because it's a term that's come into a popular use relatively recently.
There were the first people in Europe that had looked at that. And I think it was before we even broke the human genome. Craig Venter broke that human genome. And I'm pretty sure the epigenetics was before that. And so it wasn't reaching the status that it has today, where there was so much research to show that this was really happening. It takes time for new ideas and new theories to come through. But, you know, this is stuff we can test in the lab now. We can measure methylation patterns, which is, you know, we can look at how a person's genes are behaving and see which ones are switched on and off. Now we can do that. That's not, you know, something that the general public has access to, that kind of testing, but it's in the university labs, and we know that we have that capacity. So it's been around probably 25 years, maybe 30, epigenetics.
Right.
And so it makes all the sense in the world, frankly, because, you know, we know that Western diet, ultra processed foods, it leads to Western diseases, obviously. So it, you know, you can have twins and one of them doesn't have a real healthy lifestyle and the other one does. And you'll see right there, the proof is in the pudding that one twin will have some adverse health effects because of the diet and the other one has a different diet so they don't get sick, you know? So.
People have been researching this for many, many years, but the concept that food can actually have a impact on the genes and can actually turn good genes bad. That's
right.
relatively recent stuff. Now, you do, in addition to all of your researching, you do a lot of teaching special education classes, correct?
Right. That's how I supplement my income to be able to do the things that I do, basically.
Okay. And does your teaching have an impact on how you're seeing things too? Because you're working with special education children who have developmental difficulties, I guess you would call it. Does that have an impact on how you see epigenetics?
Absolutely. I've been in and out of the classroom for 20 years since I retired, okay? And you know, I'll be out of the classroom for a few years doing clinical trial work or whatever, and then back in and back and forth, that kind of thing. So bottom line is, when I first started teaching, we didn't have the caseload that we have today. The caseloads that we have today are, we've seen it. You can ask any teacher in a public school and they'll tell you. I mean, they'll tell you in college. What we're seeing. So it's like, you know, probably 30% of the kids are developmentally.
Wait a minute. Did you say 30%?
Yeah, that's what I'd say. What you have is you have your identified group, and even CDC's, admits that probably 15% of the kids are, 15 to 20% are impacted by autism and or ADHD. A lot of kids with ADHD. So you have a certain amount that are identified, and they're in a special ed program. But then you have those that who are unidentified. And you know it as a special ed teacher. Everybody knows it in the classroom, the general ed, everyone knows that that kid over there is definitely, having difficulty and with learning. So I would have to say that probably 25 to 30% of the kids are impacted by neurodevelopmental disorders at this time. Yeah.
Do you ever consider the correlation between what these children are being fed and their parents? Is there a way for you to do you talk with the children about what they eat and
Yeah, I do. I talk with the kids through the years and the teachers and whatnot. And bottom line is it's science. And so science is not necessarily as popular, and it's just not a thing that a lot of people are attracted to science, if you will. And of course, you've heard through the years we need more STEM graduates, and science is lacking, and blah blah blah. And the facts are, we've got kids. I don't know. I think the last thing I heard, 30% of kids. It was an article I read recently, and I forget what Education Today or whatever. 30% of kids did not have basic reading skills when they graduated from high school. That sort of matches what. So bottom line is,
so it could be that it's not the schools, the deficiency in teaching that's resulting in these kids coming into college without fundamental skills. It could be that they simply can't develop the fundamental skills. Is that
absolutely. They're having trouble or unidentified, and even those that do get special ed, because they're developmentally delayed from the onset, they may not graduate with a really high reading level, So it you help them and they get do better and their skills are better as they go through their school years, but it's not like they're starting out at the gate with everything,
right.
ready to. My daughter was reading when she was 3 years old, right? And we don't see the whole the population has changed in our public schools drastically in terms of learning capacity. And
Wow.
even the military will tell you that because
Sure.
they can't even get they can't get what they need in terms of recruits, to be able to pass the ASVAB and whatnot. Very few kids can pass the ASVAB. So
Now, if food is one of the principal causes, and what's in the food, I guess we should say, if what's in the food is one of the principal causes, will the causes be transmitted from one generation to the next?
absolutely. There's no doubt. If a mother's heavy metal load going into her pregnancy from the ultra processed foods, which we already know there's studies done, we don't have exact studies for, specific things. There's still studies that need to be made, but there's enough studies saying that, okay, in this study, the women who had high levels of lead in pregnancy, they had a much, much higher risk of developing. Having children with autism or ADHD, right? Lots of studies like that. But you figure a woman goes through a pregnancy with ultra processed foods and these heavy metal levels, then she's going to pass those heavy metal levels into her child. And then the child would be born with them. So we know, for example, that the study we're trying to get funded right now would show the heavy metals that are from ultra-processed foods in a pregnant woman, and then how it impacts her metal carrier protein gene, with the processed foods. Does she have the one of the problems with ultra-processed foods? If you're consuming 80% of your diet with ultra-processed foods, Then the whole foods that are nutrient dense with all the vitamins and minerals, you're not getting those. So those things, like zinc, for example, is a requirement for that metal carrier protein. So if you're deficient in zinc because of all these ultra-processed foods you're eating, and plus some of those ultra-processed foods have ingredients that are known to suppress genes from the onset. So anyway, you end up not being able to excrete these heavy metals, and they go into the child, the infant, the fetus, who then has them at the onset. And
Yeah,
so
well, wait a minute. If that's true, what happens to the next generation, the third generation?
right.
Does it not get compounded?
Yes, I believe it does. We don't have that study yet. We do know this though with the diabetes. The diabetes, if you have two diabetic parents and they have a child, that child is born insulin resistant already. So it would make sense. No one has done the study to show what happens after two generations. But we do.
Or 15.
Right. But what we're seeing is that what we see in the classroom, you've got the education corporations out there trying all different new things, and teachers need this training, that training, and the problem is not going to be solved with any amount of training. The mother has to have the proper nutrition before and when she gets pregnant. There are interventions you can do early on, like say a child's born prematurely, which many autistic kids are born prematurely. Then there's interventions you can do if they get the right ones, then they'll have a better outcome. And
Okay, we'll pick that up. But I want to go back to the very frightening notion that we seem to be compounding our evils by passing one generation's habit of eating bad food onto the next generation, who collects those sins and passes them on to the next generation. So there's two generations worth of sinful eating and the diminishment of our mental faculties, and then on and on and on. So something better be done.
yeah, something ought to be done, and you'd think these oligarchs would care, but they've gone all over the world buying up land in New Zealand and Hawaii and elsewhere, getting all the fertile farmland and building their underground bunkers and whatnot. It doesn't seem that these rich folks even care what has happened as a result of their profit-making mechanisms in the food and the medical systems, where it's all about making money. And what really, what we're seeing in front of us is the US is falling behind. Our IQ has dropped 10 points.
Well,
China.
wait a minute, wait a minute. Say that again.
So the IQ curve has shifted to the left in the US. It's dropped 10 points from what it was. And
What it was when?
years ago, when they
Okay.
were measuring. So, for example, like they have these international standardized tests, and they measure, different countries' abilities and IQs. And I think China's average IQ is 106. Ours is like 95 at this point.
Wow.
So, then you get you wonder, people complain about all the immigrants that are coming to the U.S. for the science training, and then now, they're being pushed out. Well, I asked the American citizens who are going to call, who do you think's doing all the teaching of the science? All these immigrants, there's 20, 30% of teachers are from out of the country, India, China, whatnot. They come for the training and they stay and they teach. We don't have, just like the military doesn't have the bodies that can qualify for the ASVAB and physical fitness, we are having very few students that can go on to become scientists to do that rigor of the math, the calculus sequence and the
And as you say, the probable cause is not the quality of teaching, the probable cause of our diminishment is our food.
Absolutely. There's without a doubt. Yeah. I mean, all you have to do is look at the other Western countries who have banned certain food ingredients or who required labeling. And so, like with the food dyes, yellow five, yellow six, when Europe in 2010 said you got to put a warning label on foods putting those food dyes in there, then what happened? Those food dyes disappeared from the market because nobody wanted to sell a product with a warning label may cause hyperactivity or inattention. So, those Western countries that have done something about their food supply do not have the health outcomes that we have. They're not facing what we're facing. But countries that I hear from other countries, people in Africa and whatnot, that the more ultra-processed foods they're getting, they're seeing more and more of these child developmental delays, right? So wherever those ultra-processed foods go unabated, without any control, then you're going to see these problems.
Like a bad drug.
Yeah, oh, it is totally. Probably more devastating than any drug on the either legal or illegal, frankly. Yeah.
Wow. Okay, so we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, what are we going to do? We must come up with something to do. We must come up with a strategy on how to cope with this, or otherwise, we're going to eat our country to death.
Yeah.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is Food Chain. Michael Olson with Dr. Renee Default and you. And when we come back, the epigenetics of our food and how we can fight back. Do stay tuned. We will be right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Port Ideas, Greg Williams.
There's a tremendous amount of useful information in MetroFarm for farming in or near the city.
Acres USA's Charles Walters.
MetroFarm tells how to convert an opportunity into a real going concern. Every chapter is organized around the logic of practicality. For every problem needing a solution, MetroFarm offers a progression of steps arranged in sequence so the desired goal is achieved.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning MetroFarm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
We're on the farm with Joel Salatin.
Would you like to buy homemade soup, backyard chicken, and the neighbor's artisanal lunch meat? The Farm to Consumer Legal Defense Fund protects your right to acquire the food of your choice from the source of your choice. I'm Joel Salatin from Polyface Farm, and I urge you to defend the right of neighbors to engage in direct food commerce. Join today at farmtoconsumer.org. The food of your choice from the source of your choice. That's farmtoconsumer.org. Farmtoconsumer.org. Thank you.
When you buy local American-grown flowers, flowers will grow and flourish in America. Hello, I'm Deborah Prinzing, author of Slow Flowers for Certified American-Grown Flowers. When you buy local flowers, you're helping our country's family farms reduce the transportation footprint of flowers and enjoy fresher, longer-lasting bouquets. So please, next time you shop for flowers, think local. Think Certified American-Grown Flowers. Visit AmericanGrownFlowers.org to learn more.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place aboard the USS Dale during the opening moments, 7 December 1941.
As we left our berth and got underway, the deck force was still engaged in getting ready for combat. Fuller had the job of clearing the deck of all the wooden objects that had collected in port, so Fuller was making his way aft, just tossing stuff like a madman, when he came to the ice cream freeze. Before he could toss it over the side, one of the guys said, "Hey, wait a minute!" In a matter of seconds, the lock was broken and the ice cream distributed among the crew. So, what you saw that morning was the USS Dale steaming hell-bent out to the channel while the guys back aft were standing by their guns, eating ice cream and watching World War II break out all around.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it.
on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
What do you think, ladies and gentlemen? Is it possible that bad food can make good genes go bad? And if so, what is going to be the consequence of eating bad food for generations and having generations worth of compounding harm? It isn't going to be a pretty picture that I'm seeing. Do you see the same thing, Dr. Renee DeFault?
Well, I see how this all happened from a toxicological standpoint. And what happened, Michael, this is how we can understand how we got into this fix, okay? Back in the day, to determine risk of harm, toxicology had this dose response thing going on, and they would look at one element at a time. So how much lead does it take to make somebody have an adverse effect, right? And or how much mercury or how much organophosphate pesticides. So they do the risk assessment on one element at a time. So, you know, everything.
But that's not life.
No. So what happened was, is that what we found out is that co-exposures to multiple toxicants, which is what the real world is, what we're exposed to, co-exposures, like yellow 5 has allowable 10 parts per million, 3 parts per million arsenic, and 10 parts per million lead, 3 parts per million arsenic, and I can't remember how much cadmium or whatever. Anyway, bottom line is, so, you know, you're eating Fruit Loops every day or whatnot and other things with the, you know, Mountain Dew, blah, blah, blah. You're getting these exposures, co-exposures. And so there was no risk assessment, and there never has been a risk assessment to determine the harm of all these co-exposures. Throw in the, you know, conventional flour with a little bit of bleach and mercury residue to prevent the mold and some organophosphate pesticides on top of that. Nobody, there is, in fact, to this day, we do not have a risk assessment process to determine the harm of multiple co-exposures.
Same thing is true with drugs, right?
Yeah.
People taking exactly. 15 different drugs.
Right, right. So, you know, it's been the Wild West, and especially in the United States, where anything goes, pay to play. Basically, you can sell anything to anybody. And
if you pay off the right people.
If you pay off the right people. And so the bottom line is, this is how we got to be in this state of affairs. So what it's Charles Darwin. We've got we're watching it right before our eyes, what's happening to the human being in the United States and throughout the country when there's no stopping. Everything's just happening, and quickly too. So, you know, basically, if you did finally have the proper prenatal education and diet at the front end, and then you did this for at least two generations, you would probably be able to straighten everything out. Okay.
Wow.
I would guess it would take two generations to get it fixed. I'm just saying that, you know, like as an educated guess, but
somebody who teaches special ed children,
yeah.
Somebody who looks at the heavy metals in food and has studied them. Yes.
Yeah.
I guess you're eligible for an educated guess.
Yeah. So I'm just making, so the reality is if we do nothing, then we're on this downward trend in terms of GDP, gross domestic product. Okay. Yeah. But they have AI coming on board to save the day. But the problem with AI is you have to know what questions to ask.
Example. So
there's some critical thinking skills required. Critical thinking is not rampant in our public schools these days, regardless of who the child is you're talking to. We have a problem with all the screens and the, you know, everything between the food and the screens and the, you know, they put an a Chromebook in the kindergartner's hands, you know, from day one. And so we have this, everything that's been done has created what we have now. And, you know, it is what it is. Yeah. And it's not just food. It's this other stuff. Food is definitely messing with the biochemistry, without a doubt. But there's these other things that are going on
Sure,
too.
that affect the emotions and
Yeah,
the
they have to.
intellectual processes.
Right. So we've made a mess of things. It, not we, I would say the corporations who are interested in selling these products to begin with.
Well, and you know, it was also the parents too, because the parents wanted cheap food and they wanted food that was easy to eat so they could save time. So, you know, the corporations were just giving parents what the parents wanted. So to me, the true battlefield is in the parents, and it has to be in the parents. Let me ask you a quick thing. If the children you teach in special education classes had their diets changed to whole foods, would there be an opportunity for them to recover some of their mental acuity, or are they gone?
No, the behaviors would definitely improve, without a doubt. Focus, attention. They've already done studies showing that, say, you had a teenagers in a alternative learning center and you just fed them nothing but good whole organic food, then they turn around. They're more manageable. They become the world is all of a sudden a lot brighter for these kids in terms of their outcomes. So there's
Okay.
interventions you can
So
do.
there's hope. There's
Oh yeah,
hope for.
totally.
Okay, good.
Absolutely. Yeah, there's plenty of hope. I'm not saying it's doom and gloom here.
So
We know
the
that intervention works. We know that intervention, food intervention works. But when you see what these school lunches are serving, I mean, my God, just for them to have, and many kids come from homes where they don't even have a really good meal. And frankly, they come to school for breakfast and it's probably processed, then lunch, and they go home for dinner. This is for a repeat, right? Again and again, and they're not getting the home cooked meals that they need to
they're
get.
not getting real food. They're getting the ultra processed foods
Yeah.
that are likely to contain the heavy metals that are making the mess of everything in the first place, or
Right.
helping to. So it seems to be this has to become a jihad of education. We need people like Dr. Renee Dufault, who are fighting this war, on an education basis. I also had a recent conversation with the attorneys at Wisner Baum, who won the first verdict in the Monsanto glyphosate cases, and they are now going after baby food companies and suing them for heavy metals in baby food. So I guess there's hope in people like you who are standing up and saying, and you're standing up on your own, though.
Yeah, I run a nonprofit, Food Ingredient Health Research Institute, and I have a whole board of directors, and I get support from them, moral support and whatnot. And if we do happen to get some funding, then I've got everything lined up to do the next clinical trial that'll pretty much put the nail in the coffin for the heavy metals and the ultra processed foods and the outcome to the infant. But we just haven't been able to raise funding yet. We need $250,000. But hopefully some angel will come through. But we can't get funding from the usual sources because the usual sources are only interested in perpetuating what we already have. And
Proving what they want to prove.
yeah.
And what they want to prove is what generates income for them. And so
Exactly.
that's what they'll fund. So it has to be, this has to come from a philanthropic organization of some kind. What about
Right.
the Kellogg's Foundation? Just kidding.
Yeah. I'm on the American Society of Nutrition's nutrient gene interactions research interest section. So that's a real, very well known and from the 1920s, right? They're involved in all the nutrition guidance and whatnot. Anyway, I went to their conference last year and I found saw took a picture of their long-term sponsors. And the long-term sponsors are everybody that's making these foods,
Sure.
And they wouldn't they don't want they haven't come out to say that we should reduce our ultra-processed food consumption, then they won't as far as I know. because they are still arguing about what is ultra-processed
Sure.
food. Bless their
Yeah,
hearts.
sure.
They're going
Is that somebody frying an egg? You're
to be.
ultra processing that egg, I guess.
Yeah.
So it is going to be a war that, and you're on the side that doesn't have the money, but you have the science. And how do they hide the science to keep people from seeing the science?
Well, I can tell you a few stories. That study that found mercury was positively associated with the glucose levels. That one was very, very, it got accepted by a very high level journal. And we had published with them before. And then, we paid the article processing fee and whatnot. This is like in 2000 and 13 or 14, I don't remember when. But the data was so strong because we also had NHANES data. It was very scary for people in the corn refining industry and just people out there in general. And so the publisher accepted the paper. We went through rigorous peer review. We paid our fee, and then months went by. Normally they release it within a month or even 2 weeks when it's been passed. For some reason, they were just sort of pulling us along. And then 6 months later, I find out that ADM was buying the food color in the food ingredient firm out of the Germany where this publication was being handled.
ADM being Archer Daniels Midland.
Right. And so they were buying Wild flavors. And the guy who was Peter Wild, he had been funding the research going on at this editor's college, university. A physician was getting his wing was getting funded by Peter Wild. Well, so they were holding on to that. They didn't want that. They didn't want that article published until after the ADM sale went through, which was 2 point something billion or dollars or something, and it was the m biggest sale in history for them.
Yeah.
And bottom line was or biggest purchase, right, of a food ingredient company. And so then after that went through, then we I continued to write to the publisher and say, when is this embargo going to be released? When are you publishing? And then they had a new editor, all of a sudden a new editor, and that one wrote back and said, we've decided not to publish.
Yeah.
So that was 6 months of delay, and that was behind the scenes stuff, right? And there's other stories I could tell you where there's been corporate espionage and people trying to suppress.
So it seems like the ultra-processed food industry relies on corn, soybeans, and wheat. You take these three industrially processed or grown foods, in quote, and you find ways of mixing other things with them to make them cheap and convenient. And that's the food that our nation has come to live on. And in doing so, we have come to pick up all of the heavy metals that find their way into those ultra-processed foods. Those heavy metals reside in our brain because our bodies are deficient in the essential nutrients required to remove them, like zinc. And so there the heavy metals reside in our minds and to the detriment of our mental capabilities. And then we pass them down the line to the next generation and thus compound them. So we have two generations worth of eating ultra processed foods. And then we pass that down to the third generation and on and on. And as we do so, we watch our IQ, our national IQ, go down and down and down. 20 points below China now.
10 points.
10 points below China. Wow, what a great achievement.
Know.
So
So China's publishing more science now, as you probably know.
Ah, okay, good. So where do we go from here, Dr. Renee Default?
Well,
what can we do to help you further your jihad to get the heavy metals out of our mind?
Well, if we can gather this important data that shows, the lawyers would love it, the personal injury lawyers, to have that data. If we could get that, it would take us less than a year to publish our findings. We just need the money to run this clinical trial that we already know we have the right sample size because of previous research. So bottom line is, if we could get that done, the lawyers would have a heyday. And then what would happen would be, there would be some kind of big settlement, like the food, the cigarette companies.
Exactly.
So then the cigarette companies, I can tell you right now.
I'll put you in touch with the right attorney. Dr. Renee Default, thank you so much for joining us on The Food Chain. And thank you so much for your jihad against those heavy metals that are in our food and in our children's minds. And ladies and gentlemen, I would ask you one and all to remember Michael Olson's third law of the food chain, which is cheap food isn't. Thank you, Dr. Renee.
My pleasure. Thank you, Michael.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. Now, go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.